Welcome to the Humane Roundup Podcast, where we share all the exciting stories about animal cruelty investigations, dangerous animals, and amazing rescues. Find out what goes on inside of animal shelters and all the current trends in the animal welfare industry. Now, here is your host, Daniel Ettinger.
And his amazing co-host, Ashley, just got back from vacation. Bishop!
Got back from vacation right into chaos.
How was that transition? First off, before you even get into that story, did you get bothered at all on your vacation?
Yes.
Work-related?
Yes. And I ignored the text messages from the community service officers because they knew better. And then just as I was getting ready to go into a show for the Grand Ole Opry, the lieutenant's office called. And I'm like,
what?
I'm like, man, like, I can't ignore the lieutenant's
with
office.
The Grand Ole
Opry. Yeah, right?
With your Grand Ole Opry, man. So what happened?
And it was a stupid call. It was a stupid reason for him to call me. I answered the phone because, again, it's the lieutenant's office. They're my superiors. If, you know, the lower level guys, it wouldn't have, but it's lieutenant's office. He called me because they got a call. There's a dog on one property that's on a leash, and the leash can reach the next property where the dog sits on their porch. And do we have any ordinances against that? And I'm like, Seriously?
Do you have access to the ordinances online? You could probably read that.
Right, exactly. And I said, he mentioned about reading through them. So again, why he called me, I don't understand. So I said, no, there's not really anything. Like, the best you could do is maybe if you guys have anything, you know, for trespassing, but just ask nicely for the neighbor to shorten their leash. Like, it's not that hard to figure out. I did.
Some people.
Go ahead.
Yeah. No, some people would be like, man, you know, I hate being bothered on my time off. But it is somewhat, in my opinion, like, endearing that they rely on you so much, right? Like, they trust you, right? You're a huge part of their community. And though you are on vacation and deserve to have some time away, it is nice to have that connection and trust, I guess, with your community. So that's, I mean, I think that speaks a lot of your work.
Well, and I told my supervisor about it, and she's like, they did what? They asked what? She's like, I didn't even ask you about the alligator when we found the alligator in the apartment. She's like, I already knew how to handle it, and I handled it myself. And yes,
see, now that I'd want to be called on that, though. I'd right? say, you know what? I'm on the next flight. I'm on the next flight home to mess with this alligator.
And I found out about the alligator through a Snapchat from the Humane Society.
Wow. Wow. Well, we have a good show today. I'm excited. We're going to talk some Kawa stuff. And for those of you that don't know what Kawa is, you got to stand by. It's not a cow at large. I know I probably say it funny, but we will talk about that with Jim Tedford a little bit later with the Association for Animal Welfare Advancement. Really excited about that. And well, it's going to be a fun show.
Yeah, I'm excited for it for sure.
Yeah, and then it is, I don't even know what episode we're on, but we're up there. We're like 90-something, getting close to that 100th episode. And, you know, we just want to thank our listeners and really thank everybody that's been involved. We got to thank Hildy, wherever Hildy is. Who knows? He's probably surfing or something. And then Tim doing all the editing really helps us out as well. So make sure to rate and like the podcast and, yeah, check out our Facebook and Instagram pages. And send us messages. We love hearing from you. And if you have feedback, questions, if you want specific people interviewed, or you want to come on the podcast yourself, we'd love to have you. So please,
I'm looking for Friday funny stories to post up on the Facebook page. I think we should mention too, there hasn't been a lot of interaction or anything on the website. So I think we're going to move to using the Facebook page primarily. I feel like that's where more people are interactive.
Yeah.
The phone numbers, we can put that out on the Facebook page. You can always call and leave a voicemail. We can play it on the episode and things like that. So that'll still be available. But I think the face or the website's going to go to the wayside.
It's going to go to wherever websites go when they die.
It's always on the
internet. I don't know where that is. It just dies in some sort of server somewhere. It gets overwritten. It'll become the Humane Roundup something. But yeah, we're, you know, if you want us to bring it back, we could. But at the same time, we feel like social media is the best place to really interact with you as a listener. So please feel free to reach out through there, send us messages, and we'll be happy to respond as soon as possible.
Yeah.
All right, well, let's do it. Let's introduce our guest that we have today on the program. We have Jim Tedford, who is the president and CEO of the Association for Animal Welfare Advancement. Jim, thanks so much for joining us today.
Hey, thank you both for having me. This is fun.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, we're really excited to have you. And I think it's really important for our listeners. So I think I really thought it was important to have you on and talk about the Association for Animal Welfare Advancement, AAWA, if you will, just so, because I think that, you know, a lot of people who may understand or know what it is may not necessarily see how that could be interconnected with the field work. And I think it really is, especially a lot of animal shelters have animal control, animal services, or animal protection kind of under that umbrella. And so I think it's really important to kind of hear from you. We'll talk a little bit here about the certified animal welfare administrator, those type of things. But I think for our listeners, just to get a background and understanding of kind of who you are and what the AAWA is.
Sure. So I actually have been in this industry for just over 37 years. So I have seen us go from, you know, the dark ages, basically, where we were still, shelters were still generally kind of tucked away next to the landfill, as far away from civilization as possible. And we're dealing with mass overpopulation, euthanasia as the primary means of population control, and all of that, to a place where we're in a much different world now. And I'm so excited to see the evolution of our field. You know, when you think about it, 37 years is a long time, but in the scheme of things, if you look at it all the way back in history, it's just kind of a blip on the radar. And in a relatively short period of time, our industry has succeeded in quite literally changing the world. And we have gone from a place where the shelter system was handling, the estimates were 14 to 15 million pets a year, to a place where we're handling a couple of million nationwide, and almost all of those are ending up with positive outcomes. I mean, it's a tremendous progress. And I always like to share that, because I think a lot of folks in the field who may not have been in it very long, it sort of don't realize the history. They don't realize kind of the shoulders upon which they stand. But there were a lot of folks who worked really, really hard, and there was a lot of blood, sweat, and tears that went into the progress that has been made over those years. And so I always want to acknowledge that, not only because I think history is always important, but also because, you know, I really worry sometimes that if we don't know our history, we run that risk of repeating it. And I would really, really hate for us to go back to those times where shelters were constantly overcrowded all over the country and whatnot. So really, really proud of that. As far as the association is concerned, I have been a member of this group, that we are the professional association for leaders in our field. So whether you're in animal welfare on the nonprofit side, or whether you're in animal care and control on the government side, a leader is a leader. And I believe that we are the professional association for all of those leaders. The other thing I want to stress is that we not only see ourselves as being for leaders in the sense of their titles. You know, you don't have to be a CEO, an executive director, a VP, a senior level manager to be a leader. I think we have leaders in our kennels, we have leaders in the field, we have leaders everywhere. And so if you see yourself that way, I think we are really the place for you. Our primary focus really over the years has been on professional development. So we do a lot of training. We've had a couple of face-to-face conferences every year for many, many years. Obviously, the last year and a half, those conferences have been virtual, but nonetheless, the training has been there. And we, about 2 years ago, launched our Learning Center, which is an online platform. So if you don't have the budget or you don't have the time or the freedom to travel to a face-to-face event, you can still take advantage of some really fantastic training through the Learning Center, most of which is free. All you've got to do is register. We'd love it if you would consider becoming a member of the association, but you don't have to be in order to take advantage of those fantastic training opportunities. And I think one of the things that sets our training apart just a little bit from other training is that we really do focus on that leadership level work. We're not just, you know, we're not talking very much about the operational side of what we do. There are a lot of other organizations who cover that very well. We really focus on true leadership. So we try to bring in a lot of presenters and topics from outside of our own field to challenge us to think a little more broadly and a little bigger maybe than what we have thought before as far as our own leadership development as we advance in our careers. I think there has been a sense that we're the organization for executive directors or senior leaders, and we are, but not exclusively that. We're really here for anybody who wants to advance their career. You know, I love folks who want to be the very best animal control officer they can be, and they don't aspire to be a CEO or a department director or anything. I think those people are incredibly important in our field. And the same with every other job. You know, if you want to be the best kennel tech you can be and you want to lead all the other kennel techs, then we've got a spot for you as well. So I think that's just really important to stress. We really want to be here for everybody who really feels strongly about this field as a career.
Can you talk a little bit more about go in depth a little bit more about what the trainings are?
Sure. So we've got a couple of certificate courses. For example, we've got a certificate course in organizational development. So that's really a whole series of trainings that lead you to a certificate in the end. And the point of it is to develop your team and your organization as a whole. As a leader, that's just sort of one of your core responsibilities, is to make sure that your organization runs like a well-oiled machine and that your team feels supported and are given the tools that they need in order to sort of make that happen and to advance your organization. We've got, there's a fundraising certificate course. We, as you all probably know, we have established a number of best practices documents that have been very, very well hammered out, including one on transport of companion animals as just one more life-saving tool. There's training on all of those best practices available through the Learning Center. We're always looking for new content, and it sort of covers the gamut. Daniel mentioned the CAWA program. That's our certification program. So it's the only credential for leaders in specifically in our field. And so that is the exams that were written in order for you to sit for that and achieve that certification were based on a series of domains, different topics, everything from direct animal care and interaction in the field to legislative advocacy, to leadership, to fundraising and marketing. All of those components are included in there. So there are questions included in the certification process. And we try to do a lot of training that supports what you need to know in order to be successful in achieving that credential as well. We hear a lot from, particularly from folks who are on the animal care and control side, that they don't need to know about fundraising or they don't need to know about certain elements precisely. And that's really what we try to do, is encourage folks to think beyond where they may be right now. I'll tell you, for a very short period of time, I actually worked on the for-profit side of our field and did direct response marketing and direct mail fundraising for shelters. And some of my most successful clients when I did that were government animal care and control departments. who had the foresight to actually get out there and ask their community to support things that the government may not. And they did some amazing work, and they didn't mind sharing it and talking about it. And because of that, they brought in a ton of money to support their efforts, which was huge. So yeah, my feeling is if you want to be in this field as a career, getting certified really kind of opens up so many doors for you in terms of your capabilities and your marketability. I've worked for organizations historically who had government animal care and control contracts or sheltering contracts or various other relationships. I've worked for others that were just pure nonprofit. So, I feel like having that credential really makes me as a professional in the field more marketable to a broader range of organizations. And, I think they're all important. Let's face it. I mean, frankly, I think if you have a keen understanding of what happens on both sides of that table, you're much more likely to be effective because you're more likely to collaborate with other agencies in your community.
We had Jerrica Owen on with NACA a few episodes ago, and one of the questions I brought up was, would NACA ever be in a position I'm not saying taking away from them providing their own training, but get into the business of accrediting other training, right? So I can take training from other agencies or other training places that have gone through NACA's accreditation, if you will. Is that something that you've ever looked into? Or is that the reason I ask is I think it's valuable that there is the CAWA certification, but I think it would be neat to see some of these larger organizations now starting to get into the business of accrediting smaller training. So this is a CAWA certified or an AWA certified training, though it may not be done through your specific organization.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I'll tell you, once you've gotten the certification through CAWA, you have to recertify every 3 years, which means you have to track, and there's a whole system you have to follow, and all the details are on our website, so I won't bore you with that now. But you have to actually track your continuing education, and that includes coursework that you get directly from the association. But it also includes coursework you get from a variety of other organizations. So for NACA is a great example. Most any training that NACA offers would be included and you'd get continuing ed credit for your CAWA recertification. We do the same thing with some other organizations that may be a little bit less associated with our field, like the Association of Fundraising Professionals, the AFP. A lot of their training we recognize for recertification credit. You can get CEs through them. We do a lot of coursework that's RACE certified, which is on the veterinary side. We do a lot of work. We partner closely with the Association of Shelter Vets. And so any training they offer, we tend to include as continuing education credits for. So yeah, we are wide open to that. The one thing we don't want to be is insulated and siloed as an association. I think our field for too long has been a little too siloed, and we've tended to, kind of get in our own little corners and not collaborate nearly as much as we could have. And that's something that we really want to change. We have focused really, and interestingly, the COVID year plus now has really done a tremendous amount towards helping us build those bridges. We've worked so closely with so many different types of organizations, both in our field and peripheral to our field, that I just feel like we have built bridges that will last permanently moving forward.
And that's what I really wanted to capture. I do not get the impression that the association comes across as a siloed organization whatsoever. I feel like, and I've seen it in past, that there are businesses there that are there specific to for-profit, right? And those businesses rely on, members or rely on specific attendance, et cetera. And I think we as a profession, we as a career I think would flourish if we continue to grow and put our heads together and just kind of get all on the same page. And so I realize and understand that there are businesses that do need to make money, and I'm not here to knock that. I just think that it's a nice and refreshing thing to see that there is support for other, I guess, growth and development in other ways than just a sole, if you will, siloed organization. So I appreciate your kind of refreshing view on that.
Yeah, absolutely. I have no interest in that at all. I think there's plenty of work for all of us, and we are so much stronger if we all kind of, you know, lock arms and work together on so many of these different issues. And, you know, we can still acknowledge differences. If we have philosophical differences or differences in the way we choose to operate, that's fine. I think that there's actually strength in that as well. You know, variety is kind of the spice of life. But I think when push comes to shove, if you look at all the different organizations nationally, regionally, and locally, we have so much more in common than we have that separates us. And so if we just focus on those things, those commonalities, we're going to be able to move that needle so much more quickly and so much more effectively.
Jim, before we started the episode, you were talking about a movement that you guys have going that kind of encompasses, you know, working together with everybody and things like that. You want to talk a little bit more about that?
Sure. So I was sharing with Ashley and Daniel that we're very involved, as the association is very involved, very invested in diversity, equity, and inclusion work. After the murder of George Floyd, we really, you know, it was kind of a wake-up call, I think, for the entire country, if not the entire world. And one of the things that we recognized was that a lot of local organizations were coming out with sort of statements around diversity, equity, and inclusion. And they were very well written, some of them just beautiful statements around our sort of renewed interest and focus in including everybody in our work, whether we're talking about internally to our organizations and becoming a more diverse field internally, which we have tons of room for growth in, or whether we're talking about the people we serve community and not leaving anybody behind, recognizing that there have been populations that have been long underserved in most of our communities. And so when I started reading those statements from local organizations, I thought, well, they're beautiful and they're I'm glad to see that sort of move, but somehow a statement didn't feel like enough. We really considered writing our own, and we paused for a second and said, instead of just writing a statement around our sort of position on diversity, equity, and inclusion, perhaps we should really make this a much bigger focus for our association. And hopefully, as a result of that, make it a bigger focus for the industry as a whole. So we're successful in getting some funding, and we're able to hire a consulting firm who specialize in diversity, equity, inclusion work in organizations and companies all over the country. And we've spent the last year plus building an amazing committee. Our Diversity, Equity, Inclusion Committee is just an incredible group of people who have invested a tremendous amount of time and even more energy in having incredibly difficult conversations. It's some of the stuff we have to talk about is so difficult to talk about. But we've got to have those conversations in order to advance ourselves and move our industry forward when it comes to diversity, equity, and inclusion. So we've muddled through, we've made our mistakes along the way. The beauty is we gave ourselves permission at the very beginning to do that. We knew we wouldn't be perfect because, you know, frankly, none of us are perfect. And these are tough things to discuss and things that have never really been discussed in our field. We've gone through a couple of different benchmarking exercises. Our consultants did some interviews with some key stakeholders. And then we also did what was called a playback theater experience, where we had folks from our field share their stories around DEI challenges. And then there was a group of actors who actually performed those stories in front of the group. And then we had really robust small group discussions about what we had just seen and experienced. And so we got a lot of qualitative data as a result of doing those two things. And then the association actually fielded the largest DEI survey that's ever been fielded in animal welfare. We ended up, we sent this thing far and wide. We got lots of large organizations to commit to giving their staff the time and the technology to complete it, because we wanted the opinions of folks not just in leadership roles. We wanted to hear from people at the on the front lines, all the way up to the CEO and everything in between. And we got we ended up with over 2,600 responses to that survey. So that's being analyzed right now, and that will really help us sort of establish the baseline. You know, we'll sort of know where we're starting. We have a pretty good idea. Anecdotally, we can tell you that we're not a very diverse field, but this will help.
I was going to ask that question.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm curious, is there any way to, I guess, to pull that and understand what, how diverse this profession is? Because from my perspective, it's not diverse at all.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the survey will tell us a whole lot of that. And we also, the association also, every 2 years, we field a compensation and benefits survey for our field, which is if you participate and supply your data, and the survey will be open in August. So if you're not already involved in that work and participating in that, I encourage all the listeners to go to our website and look for the details, because we would love to have your data submitted alongside your colleagues in the field. It's really helpful information as organizations sort of figure out, you know, we know one of the common reasons we hear for folks leaving the field is the pay scale. So we can figure out how to improve our compensation and benefits, we'll be doing well. We also are including some questions around DEI in the comp and benefits survey. So between the DEI survey and the comp and benefits survey, we should have a lot more intelligence around where we actually are as a field. But, you know, if you've ever been to a national conference of any kind, whether it's ours or NACA's or Best Friends or anybody else, you see that the folks in that audience are largely white people. You don't see very many people of color represented at all. And I think that's probably very indicative of where we stand as a field. So that's part of our work, really, is to open those doors, to figure out why that is the case, and to break down whatever barriers we have built up as an industry so that we become far more inclusive of all people in our work directly, as well as on the sort of receiving side of our services.
And I think that's a really deep conversation that we really don't have time to get into today, but I think part of that is the overall perspective of this profession, right? I think there's a misconception of what it is that we do, whether it's inside the shelter or in the field work, and that carries over into why would I want a career into doing X, Y, and Z. And so as we continue to advance, not only internally, it's also advancing in the way of perspective. What is it that we actually do? And I think when people can learn and realize, like, wow, like these are life-saving professionals. Like, we do so much that I think it would inspire others from any sort of background to really want to get into that. But I think when we have that, unfortunately, we still, like, we all know, the three of us here on this podcast and our listeners mostly know what we do. But I think we get jaded by it. I think we sometimes lose sight that to our elected officials, to our community members, that there's an overall sense that we're still the dog pound. We're still the dog catcher, right? We're and it's unfortunate because we've made so many strides to get through and past that, but that perception still is what it is, unfortunately.
Well, and you know, I think one reason for all of that is because we as a field have been so kind of singularly focused on the animal side of what we do, that oftentimes we've left people behind. And frankly, when you see some of the things that all of us see and have seen through the years, it becomes pretty easy to become a little bit jaded around, you know, just assuming that humans are the enemy. So that, you know, that's something that it's sort of a natural evolution. And I think it's something that now that we're really conscious of it, and we're in a much better position as an industry, because we're not dealing with the same volume of animals nationwide anymore. we're in a much better position to really now turn our focus outside the walls of the shelters and starting to really look at the community and what can we do to make our communities better and stronger. And a big factor there is to make sure that we include everybody.
For that survey that you said you guys got 2,600 responses back, which I think is phenomenal. We don't know how many, you know, animal control officers or anything like that are in the country. Unfortunately, we don't have, because there's so many definitions. How could we know?
Yeah.
and I'm assuming that includes, you're not looking at just humane officers. You're looking across the board at everybody in animal welfare for that.
Absolutely. Yep. Okay. We fielded that thing as far and wide as we could possibly get it. And you know, when you look at the response to most survey instruments that are shared in our industry, 2,600 is massive.
Yeah.
As far as a response number. So I think we're going to get some really relevant information from it. It's nobody's ever asked these questions. And so it's kind of fascinating that we got that level of participation. It tells me that people are, you know, that people are fired up, that people are really ready to be involved in making change.
Which is fantastic.
We'd love to. Yeah.
Well,
we'd love to. Yeah.
Sorry.
You want to dance on the radio tonight?
Are the results going to be released to the public?
Yes.
And if so, when?
Yeah. So the survey is being analyzed right now. I don't have an exact date as to when the reports will be ready for release, but I would say it would be within the next couple of months. I can't imagine it'll be any later than maybe late September, maybe hopefully before that. And then we've got at our conference coming up in November, we've got considerable content around diversity, equity, and inclusion. And one of the things will be sort of a release, a more public release of sort of the findings from the survey.
Well, once that's ready to go, we'd love to have you or someone from the association come and break that down if you're willing to do so.
Sure.
And I think that's a good segue into the two conferences that you do a year. Would you mind just, I think for starters, breaking down that there's a spring and a fall and kind of what are those two differences, if there are many, and how people can learn about that?
Yeah, thanks. The conferences, historically, the spring conference was for a long time called the Directors of Operations Conference, and it was a more kind of hands-on brass tacks conference. We've tried to level the playing field a bit with the two of them, and so the spring one may be a little heavier on operational content, but from a leadership standpoint, so kind of high level strategic thinking around operations and operational changes and innovations. We also tend to have a lot of development fundraising content at that spring conference, as well as some sort of admin and finance content. It tends to be heavy in those tracks. We, couple of years ago, for the first time, added a field services track to the spring conference and a shelter medicine track, and we intend to continue those moving forward as well. But again, it's not so much your, you know, how to clean a cage. It's really more, it's higher level things like team building and any sort of operational innovations and how to manage and read financial statements and all of that sort of content. Then the fall conference, has tended to be more of a sort of executive level conference with a lot of leadership training. The past several years, we've actually added a significant amount of industry specific content. So if there are big trends in the industry, we really want to talk about those. And you know, things like transport, for example, what's right and what's wrong with transport programs, and how can we really, you know, kind of push and enforce some of these best practices that we've developed. We've had a emerging leaders panel, for example, come and talk. We've had folks come and talk, panels come and talk about access to veterinary care, things like that. So it's, in addition to that, we'll bring in people. We love to have presenters from corporate America, for example, folks from outside of our field who may come in and you know, they understand the audience, so they're going to base their talk on, you know, on what they know to be our available resources as organizations, but they're going to make us think a little more broadly than maybe we've thought before. You know, things like succession planning for your team. If you know you've got a senior leader who's going to be retiring in the next 5 years, how do you plan for that? How do you sort of line up your you know, leaders to sort of move up the chain and step into those roles, that sort of thing. So it's they're very similar, both extremely high quality. We've got a number of attendees who make sure they make it to both conferences, or they'll come to one or the other. The other thing we've learned in this past year or so is that it's not enough for us to just offer a face-to-face conference. It's hugely important. I have to say, the networking opportunity, I have learned as much when I've attended conferences over the last almost 40 years now. I've learned as much in the bar at the end of the day by sitting and talking to colleagues as I have in any kind of workshops. So that piece is really important. But recognizing that not everybody can take advantage of it, I think we'll always have some sort of virtual component moving forward. I think we'll do some sort of hybrid event, whether that's capturing some content and packaging it up after the fact, so that folks who couldn't make it can still avail themselves of the training, that kind of thing. You know, we doubled and in one case tripled our attendance for conferences last year because we were completely virtual. And that tells me that that travel barrier is big. And once we take it down, people show up. So I don't want to leave those people behind again. So we'll continue doing whatever we can to make sure that we bring them content, even if they can't make it face to face.
That's great to see that there's an opportunity for that blended kind of learning, whether it's, you know, having live recorded or recordings or live like look-ins at classrooms while you're doing that. And I think
training, virtual happy hour is not nearly as much fun, but
it's not. And you know, I learned, you're so right. I love, you know, I missed it, and I love being able to go around to conferences, and whether it's as a trainer or as an attendee. You know, I went to at the time it was a SAWA conference. Mm-hmm. And I got to sit out of a classroom and talk to Phil Arkow for probably an hour, right? And like, that was more valuable than any class, and not to take away from the actual class itself, but yeah, to have that one-on-one for an hour was just incredible. Like, career changing in that aspect.
You meet veterans like Phil in our industry and get that opportunity to pick his brain for an hour, that's like 2 years of college in an hour. So
was great. I want to shift gears quickly. And before we wrap up, you know, you've been a great guest, and we definitely value everything that you've shared so far. And we really look forward to continuing this, you know, these interviews, especially as more things come up. But I want to switch gears. And I know there was a lot of talk about it in the beginning of the pandemic, and I feel like we're starting to actually see it. There were some that would refute it, but I don't know if we can, that our shelters are starting to fill up. And it looks like possibly with people going back to work, or they, you know, they got a dog or an animal during the pandemic, and it was, you know, it was kind of like it was an activity for them while they were home. But now that their life is getting somewhat back to normal, they're not wanting those animals anymore. Are you seeing that trend nationally? Is that truly happening?
Yeah, definitely happening. I anecdotally, I've talked to a number of shelter leaders who have all told me that their shelters are filling up really pretty rapidly. And if you look at the national data, you know, shelter animals count provides really great data, as does pet health through Pet Point and Chameleon and others, really offer some really good data. I think we for too long in our field have based a lot of our decision making on kind of assumption and on history, as opposed to really, I joke all the time that we're one of those fields that has never let data get in our way. But I think now we're starting to really pay attention to it and recognizing that we need to really closely watch those trends. You know, I think there are a lot of reasons for the fact that shelters are filling up again. One of those is that you know, the pandemic, as the pandemic has started to ease, although, you know, we're all wondering if that's the case with all these variants, as it feels like it's starting to ease up a little bit and things are returning to some degree of normal, I think we would have been naive to assume that the changes that happened literally overnight were going to be sustainable in the long term. I think we started to put a lot of great thought into how can we change the way we do things so that we, you know, things like foster homes, for example, you know, so many shelters moved to using a much larger number of foster homes so that they could move their animals out of the shelter environment, primarily to keep their own staff safe so that folks didn't have to come in and work in close contact with one another, caring for those pets. So, I mean, that's great. And I think, you know, we learned a lot from that, but the idea that all of that was sustainable at the level that we saw early in the pandemic, I think was probably fairly naive on our parts. Hopefully, you know, what we're seeing so far, if you look at the national data, the numbers are not back up to 2019 levels. So they're not back up to pre-pandemic levels quite yet. They're creeping in that direction. But you know, maybe we've moved the needle enough that we won't get all the way up to those pre-pandemic levels. And folks really have had a chance to stop and think about their relationships with their pets, and things will be better. And shelters won't need to be, you know, won't be quite as full. But, you know, we're dealing with all kinds of other new issues, like folks can't find enough help. There are not enough people to actually come in and clean kennels or handle transports or any of that. So, you know, now we've got situations where transports that were happening regularly from places of very high supply and low demand up to places where there was high demand and low supply, those have in many cases been either slowed down or stopped altogether just because there are not personnel to help sort of manage it and make it happen. So, you know, there I think we're what we saw was a real oddity. I think it was certainly the exception, not the rule, and I think we're returning a little bit more to the rule, to the normal. And let's hope that maybe normal looks a little better than it did pre-pandemic, so that we can build on what we learned and continue to improve the way we do things moving forward. Continue, you know, recruiting and using our communities more than we did before, not relying solely on our facilities.
Last question, and it came up recently. We have a program, the Pets for Life program, and it's a great resource for us in the field, right? It allows us to offer services to those that may be in need, like spay and neuter. Do you know of, or is there a website, or maybe it's on your website, that shows either humane societies or municipal shelters that offer services internally? So they offer spay and neuter services through their own shelter versus going, you know, to a vet clinic, those type of things. And I think the reason I bring that up is I think as we transition in animal welfare, having services provided from your own municipal or humane society shelter is going to become a thing of the norm, right? I that's what I think, at least.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think we're moving in a direction where shelters are going to be community centers. They're not going to be, and we're already seeing that in a lot of communities. You know, we're no longer just a place where animals are dropped off when they have the first bad day with their owners, or, you know, whatever. We're not going to be that sort of concentration point for all of a community's homeless animals any longer. We're going to be community centers where we're actually providing services, behavior-based services, veterinary services, who knows what else. I mean, I think the sky's kind of the limit, so that folks can come in and access the things that they may not otherwise have access to. I think that's going to be just absolutely huge. And right now we're all over the map. You know, you've got communities that have already sort of gotten there, and their shelters are already, you know, they're no longer just focused on things like adoptions because they don't have that many pets to deal with anymore. They're focused more on that outreach work. And then other communities, let's face it, I mean, we're a big melting pot as a country. So there's still plenty of communities where there are more animals than there are people to adopt them and whatnot. And we're still dealing with, you know, I won't say we're dealing with overpopulation. I really believe that we're beyond overpopulation as a nation. I think what we have now is more of a distribution problem. You know, there are lots of shelters up in the Northeast and upper Midwest, and even, you know, out in the West, there are shelters who, if it weren't for transported pets from out of their areas, they wouldn't have any animals to adopt. They wouldn't be able to meet the demand for adoption, period. So, and then there's still plenty in the deep South, for example, who are overcrowded all the time. So we've got to get those animals moved from point A to point B. We say all the time, sometimes the only thing keeping an animal from a wonderful life is a ride. If we can just give them a ride, they've got a great future ahead of them. But you know, we need to be more balanced across the country in terms of the populations. And then every community can focus on that outreach work and getting to those folks who may have sort of been flying under our radar for years and have missed out on our services.
Absolutely. And I think another service that we didn't mention is, I think we need some animal husbandry classes, probably provided by our animal welfare officers, right? As well, like opened up to the public where people can come in and learn about proper care and treatment, right? I think that in addition to some of the other services we provided would be a great resource for our community.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think most people want to do the right thing. They may or may not have the knowledge or the resources to do it, at least to the standard that we may have set for them. But I think most people fundamentally want to do the right thing. So what can we do to help them do the right thing as opposed to just, you know, kind of taking their animals away and putting them in a shelter somewhere?
Absolutely. Well, Jim, we really, really appreciate your time today. We want our listeners to check out the website. It is the AAWA.org. Again, theaawa.org. We will have a link to that in our show notes. Please check it out. Check out their conference information. Check out how to become a member. And if you want to become a CAWA, a Certified Animal Welfare Administrator, you can do it. I heard it is a hard test. I'd probably fail three times before I pass, but maybe one day I will take the leap.
I have more confidence in you than you do.
Well, thank you. Is there anything we didn't chat about that you wanted to share before we wrap it up?
Oh gosh, I don't think so. I mean, I could talk for the rest of the day.
Well, it was a great program. We really look forward to getting you back on once that survey's done. I think that would be really great for our listeners to hear. And it's just such a great and timely topic.
Love to share it with you.
Yeah, I'm excited for that information.
Awesome.
Well, thanks for joining us. We want to thank our listeners again. Please check out the AAWA.org. Check out our Facebook and Instagram page, Humane Roundup. And as always, on the Humane Roundup, we like to say, keep it humane.
Humane.
Maine. Awesome. Cool.